This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today is a longtime physician who thinks Americans go to the doctor far too often. We're talking this hour with Gilbert Welch. He's a Dartmouth professor, medical researcher, and outpatient doctor at the VA hospital in White River Junction, Vermont. He's also author of several books, all with a similar theme, that many of us consume far more medical care than we need, that we're overtested, overscreened, overdiagnosed, and in the end, Welch says, overly worried about an array of diseases that may never come to pass. And those worries lead us to seek additional treatment, he says, that can end up causing real harm. This last point is the central theme of Welch's new book called Less Medicine, More Health, a controversial message in a country where most people feel that more care is always better. Today in The Exchange, Dr. Gilbert Welch is with us, and let's hear from you. How do you view this notion that less medicine could mean more health? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dr. Welch, welcome back to The Exchange, and it's nice to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, sometimes a story is the best way to explain a concept that goes against everything we've been told. Early screening saves lives and so forth. And Dr. Welch, there's a story right at the top of your new book about an elderly gentleman, Mr. Nadeau. He's in his mid-80s. He's in great health. He goes in for his annual physical, and then what happens?
Yeah, well, let me just tell you, this was a story told to me by another physician, and it's about his father. And I heard it just a couple of years ago when I was in Boston. And his father went in to see his primary care practitioner, and the primary care practitioner examined his belly looking for a sacculation in his abdominal aorta, what we call an abdominal aortic aneurysm. And he couldn't be sure what he felt, and he thought, well, maybe I'll just get an ultrasound and check it out. And the ultrasound was done, and the ultrasound showed that the aorta was normal, but found something on the pancreas or something worrisome on the pancreas.
It sounds really scary.
Yeah,
everybody's worried about pancreatic cancer.
Maybe it's a pancreatic cancer. And so now the radiologist suggests getting a CT scan, and the CT scan shows that the pancreas is normal, but then sees something wrong in the liver. So now we're three steps away, and that nodule is concerning enough that it's recommended that he gets a biopsy. And so a gastroenterologist does a needle biopsy, and the needle biopsy comes back as a hemangioma. Now, given that what had just happened is a needle sort of the size of a knitting needle had just gone into
Yikes.
Something that is a hemangioma, which is a collection of blood vessels, you won't be surprised what happened next. He started to bleed. And then he was in the hospital for about a week, had about 10 units of blood. He developed urinary retention. He was unable to pee because he was getting narcotics for pain. And the whole thing cost him $50,000.
And he felt fine when he walked into the doctor's office originally.
He felt fine when he walked in the doctor, and just a whole train of events happened. And it's an example of how we can keep looking for things. And he wasn't benefited from any of this. He was simply harmed. And his son wanted me to share that story.
So what's the lesson from that story? Don't go for your annual checkup?
Well, I think that's one reason that you're seeing so much now questions about the value of the so-called annual physical exam. And I should be clear, I'm a primary care practitioner. I've done a lot of these things, so I want to share my conflict of interest here. But this idea that you go into the doctor and the doctor looks as hard as he or she can to find something wrong is something we really need to reconsider, because the reality now is with our technologies, we can always find something wrong.
Or worrisome, at least.
At least worrisome. It's something that needs subsequent or we can argue needs some subsequent evaluation. And so I'd like to reframe this idea of an annual physical head-to-toe looking for something wrong and move it more towards an annual, you know, not even an annual, but to check in with your doctor, not to check up, but a check in so you have a relationship with your doctor, particularly as you age. And he or she knows who you are, what matters to you, how things are going in your life, how's your job, how's your kids, how's your parents, do you have meaningful relationships, what do you value in life, that kind of thing. That makes a lot of sense. But this idea of looking hard for something wrong in people who are well is something I think we really need to reconsider.
Although, you know, doctors want to help people and they want to make sure that there isn't some, you know, creepy cancer or lurking heart disease that, gosh, I just saw Mr. Nadeau last week and he looked fine and it turns out he dropped out of a heart attack and it's all my fault because I didn't catch it.
Well, I think this is sort of the anticipatory medicine model, you know, what might go wrong in the future. And I want to be clear that more and more American physicians are very concerned about the problems I'm talking about. Many doctors are worried about the problems of too much medical care. In a recent survey, nearly half of primary care practitioners said that their patients received too much medical care. Remember, this is the doctors
Wow.
talking. Imagine the vets saying that or your dentist saying that. But it's hard to communicate the nuances of medical care, that it's really good in selected settings, particularly for people who are acutely ill or injured, but it can also do harm in others. And it's hard to communicate those nuances in the matter of 10 to 15 minutes of a clinic visit. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is I wanted to explain to patients why this idea that while some medical care may be really good and really important, there's other places where it not only does it not produce any benefit, but it can produce harm.
So what is anticipatory medicine?
Well, it's all about what might be going wrong in the future, what might happen in the future. And I think we can get so distracted by what might go wrong in the future that we get pulled away from what's happening right now.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Dr. Gilbert Welch. His new book is called Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Have you been in a situation where you perhaps, like the example Dr. Welch just gave, received too much medical care? Or are you questioning of this notion that less medicine could mean more health? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. How much, Dr. Welch, is this about follow the money, that doctors are just checking every last avenue because, one, they don't want to get sued, and two, they get paid by the test or the procedure, so why the heck not?
Well, it's certainly a huge part of the story. Money matters, and the traditional design of American medicine is we're paid more to do more. That's beginning to change, particularly more and more doctors now are employees of larger healthcare systems, but those healthcare systems are paid more to do more. So there are very strong forces at work that encourage the system to provide more services. At the same time, there's a really frothy private sector developing new tests, new treatments, new devices, and have a strong interest in expanding medical care into the well population, because that's a big market, you know, moving it beyond sick people. So money's a huge part of the story. But physicians would also want me to mention lawyers, and the legal climate is certainly another part of the story. The media is part of the story. You know, these stories of all these fantastic new things get people thinking that Of course, all medical care is good and all medical care has some opportunity to help people. And those stories tend to downplay the downsides of medical care. And the reality is all of our interventions have some harm. So I want to be clear. I'm writing about here seven assumptions that drive too much care. I want to be clear that I'm not blaming the public for these assumptions because they've been getting messaging about these benefits for years in the media and, you know, just in their daily lives. And it just requires a little bit more balance.
Yeah, and the book doesn't feel like a blame game. It feels like an exploration of where this comes from. I'm interested in what you called, I think you said, Dr. Welch, this frothy medical technology sector.
I call it the Wild West.
Is it kind of like what Dwight Eisenhower warned about, like the military-industrial complex, the medical-industrial complex?
It absolutely is, and I have to credit Dr. Arnold Relman, a former editor of the New England Journal, who actually just died recently, who coined the term the medical-industrial complex. And it is a huge market. It's a huge part of our economy now. And you're hearing about it every day. You're hearing about precision medicine. You're hearing about more genetic tests. You're hearing more about imaging tests. I just heard about a bra that women can wear that constantly is checking for breast cancer. Now, whether that
really
it's called the thermography. It's crazy, quite frankly. I don't know if I should say that on the air, but that's how frothy the underlying sort of biotech bio device industry is right now.
Although, you know, doctors must apparently want this equipment. I mean, everybody wants the latest and best, and we want to take care of ourselves. And so, you know, I've heard this from hospital executives. You know, we had a perfectly good CAT scan equipment, but the hospital down the street had the latest CAT scan equipment.
Right. So we had to buy a new one. Right.
So,
It's an increasing cycle of
intervention.
Because
the public wants it.
Right. And this is a key assumption. This is one of the key assumptions, that newer is always better. And the disturbing truth is new interventions are typically not well tested, and they often wind up being judged ineffective and even harmful. And if you want some examples of that, many of your listeners may remember the Vioxx story. You get a new drug that actually is no better than any existing drugs, but it's sold and marketed very heavily. And a few years later, it becomes clear that it doubled the risk of heart disease, and it looked like it doubled the risk of all-cause mortality in one study. Anyway, it took a while before the FDA withdrew it from the market. It's not just about new drugs. New procedures like autologous bone marrow transplantation for women with metastatic breast cancer. We did that for 10 years involving about 30,000 women in a really tough treatment before we figured out it didn't work. And then there's, of course, the metal-on-metal hip story, which is a new story about hip replacements, where we had a very good device for many years, and then all of a sudden someone decides to develop a new device, and surprise and surprise, you have two metal surfaces rubbing on each other. All of a sudden you have metal ions in the blood, and people get sick. So.
Wow.
You have to be careful about newness. Newness is not always better.
Well, and that's one of the assumptions in the book. We'll dive into the other assumptions in this book, Less Medicine, More Health, in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Less Medicine, More Health. That's the contradictory-sounding title of a new book by our guest today, Dartmouth researcher and Dr. Gilbert Welch. As we've been hearing, it's a challenge to the conventional wisdom among patients and providers that more testing and more treatment is always better. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Welch, let's go right to our callers. And Peggy's calling from Center Harbor. Hi, Peggy. Go ahead.
Hi. I just would like to hear doctor's comment on the proactive steps that Angelina Jolie has recently taken due to genetic testing to ostensibly prolong her life.
Yeah, pretty moving stuff, isn't it, Peggy? Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So what he feels about that.
Yeah, excellent question. Thank you. She had a big piece, again, in the New York Times about removing her uterus, I think it was.
Her ovaries.
Yeah. She'd already had a double mastectomy and had written about that because she has this terrible family history.
So I'm the guy that's always seen as questioning cancer screening or questioning preventive intervention. And so what do I think about this? Well, I think she made a perfectly rational choice. And the question, well, why do you say that? Well, because she's a special case. Now, it's not because she's a special case, not because she's glamorous or she's a movie star or she's wealthy or she's married to Brad Pitt. She's a special case because she's at such extremely high risk of developing ovarian cancer. The average American woman has a lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer of about 1.3%, according to federal data.
Wow, pretty low.
It's pretty low. That means 99% chance of not developing it. Angelina Jolie's estimated risk of developing ovarian cancer is 50%, 35 times higher. So she is a really special case. Why is she at such high risk? Because, one, she carries the BRCA1 mutation, and two, we have evidence that it really matters in her family. Her mother, her grandmother, her great-grandmother all had ovarian cancer. So she is a really special case. I think she made a totally rational choice.
So what about the testing, though? She knew she had – now, she had the family history, too, but – does this Angelina Jolie effect, they're calling it, does that mean that every woman should go out and get tested for these genes?
No, it doesn't. The people who should be tested for those genes are people who have a family history. We really actually don't know exactly what BRCA1 means in the absence of a family history. That's a really interesting question. But women who have a really powerful family history, it is a reasonable test. It not only is it reasonable, it's a perfectly rational test to get, although some women don't want to know. And I give an example of that in the book where some woman has decided she just doesn't want to know. She doesn't want that level of information. So it's still a choice. I think the one other thing people should understand is that this interest in genetic testing, that BRCA1 is a pretty unusual mutation, both that it's unusual in the population, but it's unusual because it is such an important mutation. Very few other things of that magnitude are going to be apparent in the genome. We knew about the important sort of mutations without having to read the genome. We learned about BRCA1 without having to read the actual genetic bases. Why? Because they're so obvious in families. So there are going to be a few that we know about, genes that are important or mutations that are important, but most of it's just going to be little stuff.
Well, and since we're talking about screening and genetics and so forth, let's talk about that message that all of us here, men and women, early screening saves lives, whether it's prostate cancer, breast cancer, who knows what else. What about that message? Is it wrong?
Yes. The idea and the assumption that the way I phrase the assumption is sooner is always better. And it's been particularly powerful for a feared disease like cancer. But our understanding of cancer is changing. And it's important for the public to understand that, and more doctors understand this, that in fact it's a very heterogeneous, very variable set of diseases. And consider what's been called the barnyard pen of cancers. And there are three animals in this barnyard, and the goal of early detection is to fence them in and catch them early. The three animals are the birds and the rabbits and the turtles. Now, you can imagine trying to fence in a bird. The bird's already
–
it's already flown away. And these represent the fastest growing cancers, the most aggressive cancers, the cancers that have already spread by the time they're detectable.
So detection doesn't really matter.
Early detection doesn't help. The question is, can we treat them? Then there are the rabbits. Rabbits are hopping around. If you build enough fences, you can catch them. That's where screening will have arguably its best effect. And then there are the turtles. And the turtles aren't going anywhere anyway. And the reality is that screening is really good at finding turtles. These are the indolent forms of cancer that it looks like we all develop, particularly in some organs. Organs like the thyroid, the breast, prostate, all have these underlying abnormalities that meet the pathologic definition of cancer. but ultimately are never growing.
That's so how do we know if that spot is a rabbit or a turtle?
That's the problem. That's the deal with early detection. Whenever we try to look early, we find more cancer than we expect to, and yet we don't know which ones are going to matter, so we end up treating everybody. And that means we're treating some people who will cannot benefit from our treatment because they're never going to experience any symptoms from their cancer. That's the problem of overdiagnosis that leads to the problem of overtreatment. And that's part of the deal when you're looking for early forms of cancer. And so everybody should know that, that there are benefits to early detection, but there are also harms. And sometimes the benefits are so small and the harms are so relatively big that I think people can make a perfectly rational choice. This is not something they want to be involved in.
How do they make that choice, though, Dr. Welch? I mean, I hear you. Chemotherapy is brutal. Why go through it if you don't have to? Especially, I have heard that this is the case with prostate cancer, where a lot of it just sits there forever.
Right.
You
die
of something else at age 90. But how do we know what's going to, again, stay a turtle or turn into a rabbit or a bird? That's the tough part. How do I make that choice as a patient?
So I think that's one of the reasons I'm trying to move those choices upstream. Before you get caught in the situation where you have some early cancer that some people say, well, maybe you should treat, maybe you shouldn't, and you ask the question, to what extent do I want to be looking for something to be wrong at a very early stage, as opposed to waiting to see something that actually becomes a problem? And I think this is a very important thing for people to think about, because we're going to be developing new tests every day. And in fact, just the other day, there's a new molecular breast imaging that finds four times as many breast cancers than mammography. Well, some people think, oh, that's great. But I think, wow, that's a huge problem. You're finding four times as many cancers? That looks like four times as much overdiagnosis. And the thyroid's a huge problem. And the poster child for that is South Korea, which over the last 15 years has had a 15-fold increase in the rate of thyroid cancer detection because they're doing ultrasounds on everybody's neck. And this is a cancer that for years pathologists have commented that it's an extremely rare form of death, but it's an extremely common finding at autopsy.
Yeah, that's amazing, that South Korea story.
Yeah, so it just shows you how far wrong we can go with a strategy of looking for really early abnormalities.
Let's go back to our listeners. And again, the phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. To Guilford next, Dr. Welch, where Mark is on the air. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is, last year my PSA was high, and the doctor made me do a biopsy. Then a month later, we did another PSA test, and the PSA was low. And, of course, they didn't find anything wrong with when they did the biopsy. And that's one issue. I think doctors are overselling, because then in September this year, my heart started racing. I ended up going to the hospital, emergency room doctor. They reset my heart. They said I had no heart attack. But, however, he told me, he recommended that I stay overnight. So I stayed overnight. The overnight visit ended up being 2.5 days.
Yikes.
They did all these tests. Nothing was wrong, other than the cardiologist came back and told me that, Mr. Ganji, you were born with defect. It's an electrical problem. It took 60 years to happen. It could happen tomorrow, or it could happen in another 60 years. Meanwhile, the bill was
$38,000. Oh, dear. Yeah. Mark, thank you for calling in. You've got stories like that in the book, Dr. Welch.
Yeah, Mark, I'm sorry. Mark talks about another set of problems that is different than the overdiagnosis problem, but all the false alarm problems. That we got all these alarms going off that we then need to check out further. This is another problem with our diagnostic technology, particularly when we're looking in people who don't have any outward problem. We can get a lot of false alarms, and it's a huge problem for screening, and it drives a lot of cost and subsequent procedures.
It's hard to blame the folks, though, that treated Mark. I mean, he's in their care. They
Absolutely.
Want to do the best by him. They want to make sure they don't release him, and then he drops dead on the street outside. So I just wonder how to break out of this. I mean, a lot of people are approaching this with the best intentions.
I think a lot of it and we come back to, you know, the origins of the problem. And the origins of the problem, one, as you said, was money. And then there's this issue of excessive expectations that I think is part generated by the media and part generated by advertising from a very frothy private sector. There's the issue of lawyers, but there's also an issue of true belief. And the true belief that medical care always helps people and is always beneficial. And I think that's one of the beliefs I'm trying to add some balance to and to understand the nuance that the people who are most likely to benefit from health care are people who are acutely ill right now or acutely injured right now. And the people that are most likely to benefit from preventive interventions are people like Angelina Jolie, somebody at exceptionally high risk.
Here's two emails, Dr. Welch, both in a similar vein. So I'll read both of them and then get your thoughts. This is Angie. She says, can you talk about the role of big pharmaceutical companies in all this? She says, there is some insane statistic like 80 to 90% of all prescriptions are now lifetime, quote, maintenance prescriptions. Many of these require more monitoring of the liver or kidney function and hence annual testing. Is this all because big pharma can't make money when a doctor prescribes a lifestyle change like proper food and exercise versus drugs? So that's Angie. And then Deborah says, please ask Dr. Welch his opinion on the overabundance of drug ads on TV. These have also contributed to our illness paranoia. So two related questions on the role of drug companies.
Oh, they're not part of the problem. Not. Yeah. they're sure they're a big part of the problem. And the let me first deal with the question of direct-to-consumer advertising and say that we're one of, I believe, only two countries worldwide that allows direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising. The other one's New Zealand. This is
so they don't allow that in Canada. You don't see ads for
This is a and it's something and it's something that changed. I think it was maybe 20 years ago, because it used to be when I was in medical school. There was no direct to consumer advertising, this has changed the dynamic greatly. Of course, the advertising is just that. It's advertising. It tends to exaggerate the benefits, tends to minimize the harms.
It's free speech.
It's free speech. But there's not a lot of effort to counter detail it. And so this, again, adds to this presumption that everything can be treated with a drug and that there are no downsides to the drugs. And there's been a great interest in expanding drugs to people who are well. And it would have been very unusual in the 60s for anyone to take a pill if they felt well. They only took medicines if they felt poorly. But now it's become routine, and it becomes a huge problem in the elderly as they get on more and more drugs. It seems to be like a one-way valve that just adds new agents are added by doctors. They tend we're much less good, and I've put myself in this category, to take people off drugs. It's a very important thing to do, particularly as people age. And one of the things that we're now beginning to get more information on is some of the downsides of being too aggressive in lowering people's blood sugar or their blood pressure, particularly as they get old, increasing the risk of fall. A study that came out just in the last month showed that treating people with normal blood pressures on two medications leads to an increase in their death rate and an increase in their decline in cognitive function. And in many ways, that's not surprising. But it really matters that we not be too enthusiastic about taking medicines.
Can you blame just big pharma, though, as our
No.
emailer puts it? Because some people would rather just pop a cholesterol pill than go to the gym three times a week and cut down on the steak.
There's a lot of blame to go around if we want to put on blame. Now, there's a lot of – there are multiple forces at work here. And I should just emphasize that food and movement are two things that all your audience should think hard about, eating well and moving.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. And let's take Lisa. Go ahead, Lisa. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I work as a phlebotomist, and I see this often where I'll have a terminally ill patient who has stopped eating and for the most part has stopped drinking, and yet the doctor is still ordering blood work. I had someone this morning who's in that position, and the doctor's ordered a test on their Coumadin level, among other things. And I think, what is the point of this? I can't help but think it's the legal system that's running the show.
And a phlebotomist is someone who does the blood draw, right?
Blood. It's
a, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. And I see it all the time. Why would you want your terminally ill parent who maybe has a week or two because left, they've stopped drinking, they've stopped eating, they're sending the message, they're ready to go. Why would you want to have them stuck with a needle?
Well,
have their blood drawn? What's the purpose?
Lisa, thank you very much for calling in. And it also reminds me, Dr. Welch, my late father-in-law, 2 weeks before he died at 86, had a pacemaker put in. So there's another procedure even more engaging than having blood drawn. But yeah, Lisa, thank you.
Well, this is a part of medical care where the problem of too much medicine has actually been an issue for 20, 30 years, and this is in care for those who are dying, where a lot of doctors recognize that our aggressive care can be inhumane. And there are a lot of people trying to work on that problem, make sure we're not doing stupid things to people in the end of their life. It is something where we get in sort of automatic sort of routines that if you're on this drug, we're going to be checking this test. And we really need to reconsider that. So the problem of too much medical care, you know, exists along the whole spectrum of life. The one extreme is too much care at the end of life. And this has spurred movements in palliative care and more sensible care. As I've suggested throughout this program, that's also relevant at the other extreme for those who are well, which is a more recently recognized problem, that it's hard for us to make well people better, but it isn't that hard for us to do something that makes them worse. But it's also relevant for people who are sick, that we can be too aggressive in testing. Our treatment can be too aggressive. We can focus on the newest, greatest drug, procedure, or device. And these may all cause more problems than it solves. Sometimes it's best to go with something that's tired and true and deal with the problem at hand without looking for a lot of other problems.
Well, thank you for that call, Lisa. And we'll take more of your calls after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Dr. Gilbert Welch. We're talking about his brand new book, Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Welch, lots of people who want to jump in our conversation, but I wanted to ask you about something you said earlier, the news media playing into this. There's a funny story in the book about two equally threatening sounding headlines. One is taller stature is linked to higher cancer risk. And then short people are more likely to have heart disease. So, you know, hopefully everybody's of medium height. They don't have to worry about it. I mean, that's just an example of some of the silliness that you see.
Yeah, you can't even make this stuff up. I mean, I was just so blown away when I saw that story about an additional inch of height conferring a 4% increased risk of cancer. And then I said, geez, well, let's look at stature. And then all of a sudden there's something about how short stature is correlated with coronary artery disease. There's going to be a sea of risk information out there about little small changes in your risk. You know, remember Angelina Jolie, her family history and her BRCA1, that increased her risk 35 times. That's 35,000% increase. You're going to see a lot of 50% increases, 30% increases, 20% decreases. We're going to find this kind of little stuff that may be related to a behavior. It may be related to an environmental effect. It may be related to a genetic aberration. I suggest people sort of tune that stuff out. Those little changes in risk, we're not even sure they're really there. Different studies show different things. And the more important question is what would people what should we be do differently about small changes in risk? And I think the honest answer is not much.
And when you talk in the news media about the book, you're not just talking about, you know, regular news media like NPR or, you know, TV nightly news. You're also talking about, you know, respected medical journals who want to have, like, the sexy article that'll sell copies.
Absolutely. All the media, even NHPR, share the same interest. They share an interest in maintaining an audience. And sometimes something that is more splashy and spectacular. And there's also an interest in sort of exaggerating and hyping various stories.
What's your thought on the vast amount of medical information, Dr. Welch, online? WebMD, I've gone to mayoclinic.com once in a while to check things out. How does that fit in? That avalanche of data, information, how does that fit in with less medicine, more health?
Well, I think it's ironically, we can get too involved in
too
our
much
own
noise.
Health. Yeah, we can get too focused on searching for health information. I believe, ironically, part of health is not paying too much attention to it. Now, that doesn't mean that you drive 90 miles an hour on the interstate without your seatbelt on. But it does mean that you don't try to react to every piece of new information or you know, observe yourself really carefully and see, you know, imagine what might be going wrong. I think a little bit of resilience a little bit of confidence about your future is important to one's health.
Well, and that's sort of a philosophical, almost spiritual point that you make in the book, Dr. Welch. Toward the end, you say, is it really, should we run around worrying all day long about avoiding death? I mean...
Right, because we're going to ultimately be unsuccessful. And that is an important, and that's the... Let me be clear. That's the most personal assumption or discussion.
Of the seven.
Yeah, uh-huh. Of the seven. It's the seventh assumption that it's all about avoiding death, because a lot of people and physicians and the medical profession can be focused on the assumption. That's really what it's about. And it really isn't what it's about. I think if we get too fixated on preventive death, which we will ultimately be unsuccessful with anyway, we will diminish our lives. Now, this is a value judgment. I'm sharing my values with you, and different people will have different values. So I want to be clear that I'm not saying this is the right way, but I think people ought to at least start to consider how they want to approach life and realize that, you know, talking about saving life can often be misleading, because what we're really talking about is extending life. And the question is, you know, to what extent can we do that? And if we can do it, what quality comes with that extension? And those are all things I think we all need to grapple with.
All right, let's take some more calls. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to Joan in Manchester. Hi, Joan. You're on the air with Dr. Welch. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, actually, let me just preface it by saying I agree with quite a bit of what is being said about over-testing, over-treatment. One of my concerns is that insurances do not pay for alternative medicines. And also, one of the reasons, and I'll give you two examples quickly in my life, that people want testing is because doctors don't necessarily have good listening skills and don't listen to the symptoms that are being explained. And so we develop a lack in the faith in the doctors or their training. And I'll give you two quick examples. One was in my 20s, back in the early 80s, I actually had postpartum depression and had gained quite a bit of weight within 6 months of after having my baby, went to the doctor, and his response was, lose weight and you'll be happy. And that led to all kinds of problems down, you know, in quick order after that. And then the other thing is, probably about 25 years later, I developed what became a really chronic decline in thyroiditis. I again gained weight, started losing hair, But the doctor kept saying, your numbers are kind of on the high end of normal, but still normal, and wasn't listening to my symptoms.
Ultimately,
long story short, I wasn't listened to. I finally found a doctor that would listen to me. Then when they took the thyroid, it was riddled with cancer, and I understand that's not the worst kind of cancer. However, they then again made another mistake trying to be conservative and only took half the thyroid, and then a week later had to call me in to get the other half.
Wow, Joan, well, thank you very much for calling in. And, you know, there's so many points here. I'm not sure which one to follow up on, but
go ahead. One I want to follow. I think Joan raises the question of communication skills and how good doctors are at listening. And I do believe that our propensity to order tests or start medications or make referrals is sometimes done as a way to express that we hear the patient.
Now, express concern.
Hear you. You're heard. We're going to order a test. We're going to start a medicine. We're going to make a referral. It is not necessarily the right way to do this. It may be a way to compensate for less than ideal communication skills.
It's tricky,
isn't it? I think it is one of the forces at work. Is sometimes we think, well, that way the patient will feel heard, and it's not necessarily the right way. I mean, sometimes it's exactly the right thing to do, but certainly not always.
Yeah, it's tricky. In this instance, it sounds like she wanted more tests. She felt sort of disrespected, like her symptoms weren't being taken seriously.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can comment on exactly what was happening.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to get at with you, Dr. Welch, is it's really tough because if you're a physician that has sort of more your mentality of you don't want to overtest, overtreat, but then sometimes you're accused of being disrespectful and not listening.
Right. And I, to be fair, for doctors in a 10 or 15 minute visit, sometimes the most efficient way to help a patient feel heard is to do something, even though doing something may not be the right thing to do. And sometimes, you know, one of the most important pieces of diagnostic information we can get on a patient is about time, about how things are going over time, getting a sense of the slope of curves. Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? That's a really important piece of information. It takes time. It takes time both at one visit, but it takes the time of having another visit and so forth.
That's the thing, because doctors are so pressed to see patients in 20-minute increments.
Right. And sometimes, you know, I'd argue we're seeing too many patients because we're seeing patients who are well, and that's because we're inviting them in and so forth. And we would probably be better off focusing on a smaller subset.
Well, Joan, thank you very much for calling in. And let's go to Lebanon, where Megan's on the air. Hi, Megan. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, my question is about children. And for our school district, having a yearly physical or a well-child visit is required. I was just wondering the doctor's thoughts on well-child preventive visits where you have to take your child into the place where all the sick kids are.
Yeah, certainly during the flu season, I'm thinking about that too, Megan. Thanks a lot for calling in.
Well, I should be clear, I'm not a pediatrician. I should be clear also that although I'm someone that questions the value of cancer screening and questions the value of preventive interventions, I'm strongly supportive of immunizations. And I won't say that in general. There are a few where I might quibble with, but in general, it's been a really important thing that we've done for children. And that, I think, is the origins from of where a lot of that well-child visits came from. The other part of the well-child visit that's important is particularly early on in infants and toddlers is to help parents, particularly new parents, develop good parenting skills. That said, when we get into elementary school and high school sports physicals, I'm not sure exactly what we're doing there. And these are the kind of things that we need to really think hard about.
Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Nancy who says, can you explain why routine mammographic screening of asymptomatic healthy women, especially ages 40 to 49, may lead to overdiagnosis and overtreatment for many, and that choosing not to have mammograms may be a reasonable choice for some women? Nancy, boy, we could do hours and hours of discussion on this, but it's a great question. And, you know, speaking as a woman, you do feel pressure to get it every year. I mean, your wonderful OBGYN or regular doctor says, you know, Laura, time for your mammogram. Have you scheduled your mammogram yet? Time for your mammogram. And, you know, I've been with the same OBGYN for 20 years, so of course I'm going to do what she says.
Well, let me just say Nancy brings up what is a perfectly rational choice, not to undergo mammography. Mammography is a really close call, if we're honest about it. And it is a test that has been promoted in a way that probably no other test has been. It is now, for some healthcare systems, it is a measure of performance for the doctor. To what extent are all women over a certain age getting a regular mammogram? And this puts physicians in the role of coercing women, you know, scaring them about the possibility of something going wrong just to get their grades up. So that's really unfortunate. The truth is mammography is a close call. And I should be clear at the outset, there's really good news out here. The good news is that breast cancer mortality is falling. The death rate has fallen about 30% in the last 20 years. That's a tribute to the oncologists and the better treatments that we have for breast cancer.
It's not early screening
it
saves lives?
It is probably not early screening, or the screening has had a very small effect. This has been an area I've studied a lot. And what the main effect of screening, the primary effect of screening, is to find more cancers. And it's finding more ductal carcinoma in situ. It's finding more small invasive cancers. And it looks like a large proportion of those represent overdiagnosis. It's led more women to have surgeries for cancer. And then there's the whole question of the false alarm rate with mammography, which is unconsciously high in this country.
And the biopsies, it looks like
among 1,000 women undergoing annual mammography for 10 years, this is from the mammographers' data themselves, upwards of around a half, 500, will have a false alarm sometime over those 5 years. So, and no organized screening program would accept that. The Europeans kind of snicker about our false positive rate in mammography. I think it's outrageous. It's neither humane. It scares a lot of women unnecessarily, nor is it efficient. You know, it leads to a lot of subsequent testing that costs patients real money. So, this is a really tricky area. I believe mammography helps a few women. I think it leads many others to be scared unnecessarily, and it's a non-trivial number to be treated for breast cancer unnecessarily.
How do you, Dr. Welch, given that you've been talking about this, writing about this really for years, how do you interact with the disease advocacy groups like the breast cancer groups, the heart disease groups, the leukemia societies? How do you sort of talk to those folks who are always saying early screening saves lives, detection saves lives?
Well, I think it's important to give a more honest message that talks about both sides of the story. And I should be clear that more and more women's group, including the Breast Cancer Coalition, recognize that mammography is not the test that it's been cracked up to be, that it does have some problems. So I think there's actually, within the women's community, there's more understanding of the two sides of mammograms. That said, there are still some disease advocacy groups that are very very aggressive in their support of screening tests. And sometimes this is with the best of intentions. It just seems so logical. Of course, it's always better to look for early forms of disease. But increasingly, I think more and more people understanding that there's really two sides to that process. And the downside of that process is you find too many people and you treat too many people.
You know, I don't like to bring myself into this conversation,
okay,
but I'm going to do it.
Please,
I'm going to do it.
Yeah, we only got a few minutes.
I have a dentist appointment on Monday.
Oh, we're going to talk about dentists.
And they're going to do the oral cancer screening, right? They feel around your throat and it's fine. And you write about this in the book. That's why I bring it up.
I know.
So, and every time I go in, they do this, and every time I'm fine. But what if on Monday, Dr. Welch, I go in and they do the little feel around the throat, and then they say, ooh, Laura, you have a funny lump here that we've never felt before.
Right, and then they'll ultrasound it, and the next thing they'll do is they'll find something on your thyroid, and the next thing you know, you'll be dealing with the question of whether you should have your thyroid biopsied. And if you have your thyroid biopsy, there's a reasonable chance we'll find a small papillary thyroid cancer. And these are the kind of questions we all need to think about. To what extent do we want to be anticipating what might be going wrong in the future with the knowledge that we all harbor abnormalities? And we can increasingly find things in people that are plausibly worrisome. And I think we need to reconsider exactly what our relationship to medical care should be. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to help people develop, I hope, a more balanced view towards medical care, which can do a lot of good for sick and suffering patients.
And there's a quick 7-minute video that Dr. Welch has done on the book. You can find it on our website, nhpr.org. And Dr. Gilbert Welch, it was great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.